GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. I'm your host for GreenSense.
And I'm Bob Kessler, working the phones, spinning the knobs, your executive producer.
And we're exploring environmental issues, we're learning about sustainable innovations, and we're meeting the passionate people that are changing the world.
Whose ideas make common and economic sense. That's how they get on the show.
And for me, they got to show why they're good for the environment. And this week, we will meet
Rebecca Chesney of the Food Futures Lab. So the future of food, we're going to take a ride down the Ray. That is a high-tech highway in Georgia. Their latest innovation, it's going solar. We'll also check in with Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News on indoor growing in cities.
How are we going to fit all this information on this week's edition of GreenSense? Well, if you stay tuned, you'll find out how. Growing Green, our regular segment on urban agriculture, is back with Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot of nonprofits are getting into the way we eat, trying to change it and make it more productive. And you found some interesting examples out there. Share that with us.
Yeah, so we actually have an example of that here in Dallas. It's a nonprofit called Grow North Texas. And really what they're doing is trying to encourage people to think twice about what they're eating and where what they're eating is coming from.
Well, that's always good to know where what you're eating is coming from. And it's hard to say too, isn't it?
It is. It's a mouthful. It's quite interesting that a lot of people, you know, we're a country, I think, that is really made up of convenience, especially when it comes to how busy we are, how so many things are happening in our lives, and we're constantly being bombarded by family issues or whatever the work issues or whatever it is. And I think one of the things this group here in Texas is trying to look at or trying to help encourage and promote is take a couple of minutes, understand your food, understand where it's coming from, and understand how your purchasing decisions can help to improve the farming communities and your local cities.
Well, we talk a lot about why food that's grown locally is good for you. Give us the highlights. Why is it good for you?
Why is it good for you? That's a loaded question. It's good for you because whenever you take the time to learn where your food's coming from and what your food is made up of, it's good for you because you're making better selections in how you're feeding yourself, how you're feeding your family, and what your diet is made up of. If you rush into, you know, if you don't pay any attention to what you're buying and what you're feeding yourself, you have a tendency to make the decisions of whatever is the easiest for you. Then the other parts of why local is good, in my opinion, is local means a lot of things to the community. The more dollars you spend locally, the more you know about your neighbors locally, the stronger your communities are going to be, in my opinion.
Can't you have a bad farm that's local?
Oh, yeah. You can definitely have a bad farm that's local. And that's what's great about the capitalistic system is a bad farm that's local probably won't be around very long, right?
Yes.
If the farmer's not providing good quality produce on a consistent basis, it's going to be difficult for that farmer to make a living. And that's a really interesting thing about what Grow North Texas does is they try to represent all the local farmers by giving the consumer access and knowledge to where those farms are and what they're growing. They hold a lot of local events trying to introduce the farmers to the public in the community.
Does anybody out there rank farms, something like a U.S. Green Building Council who has a LEED-like system that ranks farms based on a number of parameters on how they use water, energy, cleanliness? Do you know anything like that? Does that exist?
I don't know anything like that. You know, the only thing I can really say is how people's experiences travel by either the internet or word of mouth in terms of their experiences they have with their local farmers. A lot of times also those are farms that are doing something to package or process their food. And that brand becomes something that people look for at the store because they have a good experience. And we oftentimes relate what we eat in the environment in which we consume what we eat to, you know, pleasurable experiences.
This trend of eating local and knowing where your food comes from is not just a fad. It really is a trend. What do you think is spurring it on?
For some reason, I think that with all the technology that we are exposed to daily, the constant bombardment of technology, I think people look at food as something that's comforting, something that reminds them of the past. And I think a lot, especially when you're in the cities, I think a lot of people are so far removed from their agronomic background or the agronomist background. I think that this is a way to kind of reach back and find some memories that are very comforting, and experiences that are very, in some ways, romanticized about how nice it is to have food from the farm.
So it's a bit of nostalgia, I guess, mixed in with modern technology.
Yeah. And I think for those of us who grew up on a farm, we know it's hard work, right? A lot of people look at farms as, you know, these Norman Rockwell-esque pictures. But those of us that are in farming today and have been, you know, either grown up or around farming through their childhood, we might have a different memory but of how difficult that work was. But at the same point in time, you know, I think that what farmers represent is something that's wholesome and good and that people want to relate to.
That's Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News with Growing Green. I'm Robert Colangelo. Remember to subscribe to our Green Sense podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher when you visit greensensefarms.com. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Georgia on my mind. That's the immortal Ray Charles with his tribute to the great state of Georgia. Do you know about the other Ray that Georgia is known for? I'm talking about the stretch of highway called the Ray, named for entrepreneur and philanthropist Racy Anderson. It's a proving ground for technologies that will transform the transportation infrastructure of the future. And here to tell us more about the Ray and its new solar features is Executive Director Allie Kelly.
Thank you so much. How are you doing?
Fantastic. And I've been to Georgia many times. I've never heard about the Ray. And I'm sure there's many of our listeners, especially the ones that are outside of Georgia, that have never heard about the Ray. So tell us more about the amazing highway, its history, and some of its high-tech, sustainable features, in addition to the solar roadway I mentioned.
Absolutely. Well, a couple of years ago, the state of Georgia decided to name a stretch of Interstate 85, which is on the west part of the state, decided to name that stretch after Ray Anderson, who was the CEO of Interface, the billion-dollar carpet tile company. And naming highways in order to honor people and their legacy is not uncommon in our state and across the nation. What is uncommon is for a group of people, even a foundation, to come behind a road memorial and try to affect real change on that memorial road. And that's exactly what the Ray has done with the Racy Anderson Memorial Corridor. Ray was a very successful and aggressive global CEO, but he was also aware that the planet must support future generations of his family and future generations of all families. And he was best known at the end of his life for really being the father of industrial ecology and the father of corporate sustainability as a priority. So it was clear when a highway was named after Ray Anderson that we needed to create a place on that highway where we were more sustainable, we were more technological, we were more focused on innovation and saving lives in order for that road to really honor the legacy of Ray.
Well, tell us about some of the unique sustainable features that are in that stretch of highway.
Sure. Well, we have on the Ray the first installation of solar road pavement. This is a technology that has been studied and has been paved in France over the last 5 years. The company is called Wattway, and when Wattway decided that they were ready to pave a solar road outside of their home country, the Ray was the first place in the world that they went to install their solar road pavement.
And how does it work?
Small, Yeah, we have a small pilot site on the Ray, and what it is that it takes advantage of existing infrastructure, so you don't have to pull the existing road out. These are solar panels that are simply laid on top of the existing road, and then there's a recycled glass overlay that protects the solar panels, and it also creates a very skid-resistant, safe surface to drive on. These panels are very durable. They've tested them with 18-wheelers at full carrying weight. They've also tested them with tour buses full of people, even some construction equipment. So they're very durable. They've got a lifespan of about 10 years, and the energy that we are generating with our Wattway on the Ray is directed to a DOT facility, because DOT is our partner in these innovations. So the DOT facility gets the benefit of that clean green power from the sun.
One of the issues that I would think is that there's so much traffic out there. Does that ever impede the ability for sunlight to produce energy through the solar panels?
Absolutely. When there's a car or a truck over that space of pavement that has solar panels paved onto it, then the sun is blocked from reaching the panels. So for the millisecond that you have a car or a truck over the pavement, then you're not going to be generating energy. But have you ever wondered if the road could be multitasking like the rest of us? You know, that we've got a lot in our world. I mean, even microwaves now have technology that allows them to be smart. So we have asked the question at the Ray, you know, if we have smart cars and smart homes and smart buildings and smart cities, why is it that the road hasn't kept pace with the technology that is clearly already existing to make the road a safer and a more valuable piece of infrastructure? And we're convinced that the road could be doing other things when it's not being used for driving.
So that's a whole new name to complete streets, smart complete streets.
It is. I mean, we, as with DOT as our partner, we are committed to preserving the core mission of roads, which is to get you safely from point A to point B. Our question is, when there's not a car on a road, what else could that road be doing? And that same question applies to the land alongside the road, which we call the right-of-way. You know, what could that right-of-way be doing during the times when it's not being used by a motorist in distress?
We're talking about the Ray and its new solar feature with Executive Director Ali Kelly. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. So you're talking about having roads that are multitasking, and you're talking about using the right-of-way. What unique sustainable features have you come up with?
We are soon going to be constructing a 1 megawatt solar array on the right-of-way of the Ray. That will be the first solar farm along a highway in the state of Georgia, and only the fifth solar farm that's constructed along a highway in the United States. And after we construct that solar farm, we have already begun talking with DOT about also deploying wind turbines to make a wind farm on the highway right-of-way. We believe that the land along the highway could be used for generating clean energy. We think it could even be used for farming.
I think that's a fantastic idea for renewable energy generation. But tell me a little bit about what the purpose of the right-of-way is.
So the right-of-way is there to allow a clear space for drivers in distress to pull over at intervals if they need to. Some right-of-way is effectively blocked off by guardrail, which the guardrail is intended to try to keep vehicles on the travel lane. There are other pieces or parcels of right-of-way that don't have a guardrail, and those areas of right-of-way can extend for any number of feet. Generally speaking, the federal government likes to see 30 feet of right-of-way preserved for a motorist in distress. And so what we've been able to do on the Ray is to find an area at a highway interchange where we have appropriate setbacks for drivers who are in distress, and the remainder of the right-of-way can be used for generating solar energy.
Well, that's fantastic, because one of the biggest hurdles with sustainability is breaking through codes. And one of the toughest codes is the DOT federal regulation. So I'm amazed to see that you've been able to permeate that. And I think that's a fantastic dual use of land, renewable energy production, you know, as well as the right of way. Farming, yeah, I'm not so sure of. There's so many emissions from cars, so I'm not sure about the safety there, but tell me what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, right-of-way farming is pretty commonplace in other parts of the world. Asia, for example, does a lot of right-of-way farming. You don't necessarily have to be growing food on the right-of-way that you would then ingest, and you'd be worried about the pollution. An idea that we've had on the Ray and that we're exploring is sustainable fibers grown on the highway. Sustainable fibers could be wheat, could be bamboo. These are products that are more and more being incorporated into paper products so that we're not relying on so much wood. And so these sustainable fibers that go in paper products or, you know, baby diapers or, you know, other things that we would use in the kitchen or in the restroom, these could be supplied by something as simple as wheat grown along the hundreds and hundreds of acres that we have on the Ray, and imagine how many acres of right-of-way are being under-leveraged and underused across the United States. And that's really the nut of what we're trying to do. You see, once you start thinking about it when you're on a highway, there's so much land and there's so much infrastructure that is used for only one thing. And our question is, you know, is our infrastructure being underutilized? And if it is, how could we leverage it better to produce some additional value? With these things, you know, you're talking about revenue streams from generating energy, from harvesting sustainable products like wheat or bamboo. You're talking about new revenue for the Department of Transportation. And we're all keenly aware that we don't have enough dollars to maintain safe roads, safe bridges, and to modernize that infrastructure. So here we could find a way to better leverage the infrastructure that taxpayer dollars have paid for in a way that produces new revenue streams for DOTs to reinvest back into that infrastructure so that we can have smart, safe roads.
Allie, thanks for showing us the sustainable light on the Ray. We appreciate you joining us on Green Sense.
Thank you.
That's Allie Kelly, Executive Director of the Ray, joining us on Green Sense. You could read more about it and see pictures in this week's show notes. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Rebecca Chesney is the Research and Partnership Manager for Food for Futures Lab with the Institute for the Future. We met at an XPRIZE visioning workshop in Las Vegas about a year ago, and our task was to develop a global contest for food. And she joins us now here on Green Sense. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you have a very interesting job. Is there a book that you've read that was profound and had a real impact on your life?
I would say, well, there are a couple. So I was in about 2009, 2010, I was working as a financial management policy analyst at the World Bank, which is not so much related to food. And at that time, there were several books that had come out into kind of the sort of the public sphere about food, and including Michael Pollan's books. I read some of Marianne Nestle's books. I just got really interested in looking at the world through the lens of food. And, you know, in these kinds of books, people really unpack a lot of the different, the kind of the contexts for food policy, how it links to information, how it links to regulation, how it links to kind of the business landscape. And those were really transformative to me because I always really enjoyed food and getting to know people and places when I travel through food. But this was eye-opening in the sense that food can actually be a way of understanding humans and understanding our society. So from there, I went to do a master's in anthropology of food at SOAS in London. It's part of the University of London, and there's a really big food studies program there. And actually I just had a student ask me just this week for recommendations for books. And what I like to tell people is to find a book about a particular ingredient. So there's one that I really enjoyed called Cod by Mark Kurlansky. There's one that's just come out that I'm really excited about reading. It's about collard greens. It was written by a geography professor in the Appalachia region. And when these authors write about one particular ingredient, they sort of trace its history, and they really unpack from there the relationship to cuisines, to migration over the last centuries, to a lot of times tax laws were built around foods. Like in Italy, there was a tax on salt, which is why Tuscan bread is less salty, because there was a tax there. So you really learn about history. Yeah. So that's always my recommendation to people. If they're interested, start with a book that's about a particular ingredient, because that allows you to have that kind of deep dive experience, but focused on one ingredient. And then the next time you eat it, you think about all of those things. And that's so in my role now, we're looking at the future of food. One of the really fun things about it is that because we all eat, so, you know, when I eat cod now, I think about all the things I learned in that book. And so as people are eating, it's a really great opportunity to get people thinking about the future and the challenges that we face, the opportunities that we have, because we all eat. So it is kind of a foundational point of view, you know, foundational experience we can all share. So that's our work at Institute for the Future. We really like to think of eaters as people who are making the future with all of the choices that they make around food.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Rebecca Chesney, Research and Partnerships Manager, Food Futures Lab with the Institute for the Future. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Well, you work at a nonprofit research organization, the Institute for the Future, and you look at how food can be used as a lens to reinvent how we live, work, and connect with one another. How have you seen that take place in your experience?
So we look at a variety of ways that people are using food as their lever for making change in the world. So of course, we have these ideas around as an example, I know some of your work is really around farming and new approaches to farming. So what we do is track what we call signals of the future. So a signal is a very specific, discrete, emerging technology, or it can be a data point. So for instance, last year was both record temperatures for the world, as well as record number of refugees in the world. These are kind of data points that we track that show sort of a particular direction that the world is moving into. They can also be social innovations. So the ways in which people are looking at the use of public space. So as an example, in Dallas, which I'm from the DFW area originally, there's a university, it's a historically Black college, and they're sort of looking at employment and training and the role in that the university could play in food systems. So they actually had an old football field, which is common in Texas, and they converted that into a farm. And now students work on the farm, they learn skills and kind of management and teamwork. And then some of the food goes to the university. Some of the food actually goes to the Dallas Cowboys Stadium, some of the restaurants there. So these are all different ways that people are using social networks, technology, policy around food as a way of really achieving environmental resilience or economic development, social justice, healthier bodies.
We were quoting the Financial Times recently, in an article about robots that are used to do food prep. So in some cases, this was a novelty. One application was at amusement park. How soon can robots in food become the norm? And what are some of the pros and what are some of the cons to that?
So we're already seeing this happen in these early cases in the more kind of eater-facing opportunities, like in a restaurant. there is sort of this novelty of it, of people get really excited when they see these robots that are, you know, juicing fruits or making coffee. It's anytime we see something that's very new, we haven't seen it before, there's always a lot of questions that are asked about it. So some of the pros are, interestingly, because a lot of these technologies are cloud connected and run off these databases that are constantly learning, what we're starting to see is that there's actually in a lot of ways a kind of a leveling of the playing field in a new way. So as an example, there's a farmer in Canada who used a variety of technologies. He used a drone technology through their API, which is the application, you know, it's the ability to basically connect different software pieces together. And he created his own self-driving tractor. So you can, there's a video that he posted on YouTube, and he's driving a combine, and this tractor comes up next to him and it's driving alongside next to him, and there's no driver inside of it. And he was able to put several different technologies together to basically create a GPS connected kind of self-driving tractor. And this is someone who's not an expert in robotics. He's just really interested and spoke with a lot of people and learned how he could put the pieces together. And that's really the what's accelerating this innovation, is that because there's so much software in the world around us, inside these robotic systems, inside a tractor, inside your phone.
It's been really great to talk to you. We'll have to get you back on the show. There's so much interesting things that you have to tell us. We look forward to speaking with you in the future.
That sounds great. There's lots to talk about with the future, so happy to do that.
That's Rebecca Chesney, Research and Partnership Manager, Food Futures Lab with the Institute for the Future. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is Green Sense. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. We'll be back next week with...
Well, Robert, a special show. No, well, they're all special. Okay, this one's special to me. My favorite band in high school and beyond was Talking Heads, so we have the guitarist from Talking Heads, Jerry Harrison, who is a great musician, but he does a lot of other stuff. Smart guy, and he is part of a new crowdfunding platform called Red Crow, so we'll meet Jerry. And we'll check in with someone from the Roddenberry Foundation. Yeah, the Star Trek Gene Roddenberry. They just gave out their big prize for all kinds of awesome game-changing innovations.
Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. To do that, you have to stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.